my book, Prophets of Reason, as Eugene said about somebody he's also worked a lot on, Michael Mashaq, who lives through most of the 19th century in what's then Ottoman Syria, so Syria, Lebanon of today. He also spent some time in Egypt. He's born in the year 1800 and dies in 1888. And I suppose the my sort of way into his life, or the reason why I became interested in his life, was to do with a kind of problem that we have in addressing the 19th century in historical scholarship, that reading some kinds of accounts of the 19th century Arab world, and particularly, you know, Bled Hashem and Egypt, one can see this is the origin point of tendencies like secularism, or the idea of a secular society, new engagement with modern science, the idea of a kind of public sphere, which is multi-religious, where different sets of people can debate. That sort of not the image, if you like, of the 19th century. On the other hand, it's also the century of modern-style sectarian violence, things like the famous 1860 massacre of Christians in Damascus by a large crowd of armed Muslims, which Eugene has just published a book about, and also of the rise of, you know, religious revivalist movements, Christian, Jewish, also Muslim, you know, early Salafi movement and things like that, that are defining religious identities often in rather harder and more clearly bounded ways. So there's a bit of a paradox. So how do we see the 19th century as embodying, you know, the beginnings of both of these tendencies in their modern form? And I found, you know, Michael Mashaq helps us, I hope, to answer some of those questions, because he belongs in a sense to the history of both of these tendencies. So very briefly, he is born in 1800. He grows up as a Greek Catholic, Rum Catholiki, in Deir al-Qamar, the capital of the Emirate of Mount Lebanon. His family is very close to the ruling Shehebi family, the Emir Bashir Shehebi. And at the age of 17, he travels to Egypt, to the port town of Damietta, and encounters basically two things, one of which is the plague, which comes to town regularly in the spring and remains for many months into the summer, and poses a problem to everybody in Damyat, because, you know, it's killing many people. You have at its height 100 funeral processions leaving the town every day. But people react in different ways, and the wealthy Christians that Michael Mashaq is living along most go into a kind of lockdown, kofla, it's actually, they call it what you call lockdown, to hide away from the plague and these sort of quarantine regulations. Other people would resort more to prayer, or indeed to magical means of warding off the plague. Doctors are uncertain and, you know, divided on what the best way is to deal with it. And so one can see through this example in particular of plague, you know, different ideas of what one should do about these problems in one's life, whether religious or medical or magical, kind of rubbing up against each other, and the problems of what to believe, what one should think about this, that this gives rise to. The other thing that Michael Mashaq encounters in Damietta is a set of writings translated from European languages into Arabic, the first time that modern science of the kind that's written after Isaac Newton, or the Enlightenment thought of French deists, people like Voltaire and Volney, is available in Arabic. And this is the result of a particular translation movement which is based in that city of Damyat. And through reading this and through other experiences that he has in Damietta, Michael Mashaq loses his faith. He decides that all of the religious faiths that are available to him in Egypt or Syria at the time are false, kulla shara'a batila, and that we should instead act according to the natural light which has been planted in us by God. So he adopts a deist position. Not publicly, he remains for public purposes a Greek Catholic. And then he goes back to Mount Lebanon, and he lives there for the next part of his life. He becomes an advisor and chancellor to a set of the local rulers in a town called Hasbaya and Wadi Taim. He becomes a great polymath. He teaches himself a whole range of different disciplines, from music to mathematics, and, you know, medicine. He falls ill. He decides he will teach himself medicine, so he because he doesn't trust the other doctors, you know. So he has this great faith in his own ability to, you know, think his way to the end of any problem he's presented with. Then in the 1840s, well, the 1830s and then the 1840s, there's a new set of problems which present themselves because there's new political changes in Belle de Chem, an invasion by the army of the governor of Egypt, Mehmed Ali Pasha, and then a European intervention to get him out and restore Ottoman power. And through all of these political changes, Michal Mashoka is very involved in the local politics. He works with the Egyptians, he then works closely with the British, and he's negotiating, in a sense, parts of the ending of the old order of the Shehebi Emirs and those sort of political forces in Mount Lebanon. And in one of the sort of outcomes of this is the emergence of a new form of sectarian politics and sectarian violence. In 1841, in Mount Lebanon, there's a conflict between Maronite and Druze Christians. And in the course of this, his own family home is burnt down in Deir el-Qaban. One of his brothers is killed. The rest of the family flee to safety with him in Damascus. And this, I think, affects him very deeply. And it's not coincidental that it's a few years after that that he begins becoming interested in religious ideas once again. Instead of simply being a deist, he begins to take seriously writings which have been translated into Arabic by Protestant missionaries who've come from America to the Eastern Mediterranean in the 1820s, particularly a rather peculiar book by a man named Alexander Keith, who's a Church of Scotland minister, which purports to show that the Bible is true based on archaeology. So he reads this stuff. He becomes then, meets and becomes a close friend of one of the American missionaries, a man named Eli Smith, in the town of Hasbaya, which is where he spends a large part of his life and where a group of people have become Protestants recently. And as a result of this, eventually in 1848, decides to become, for public purposes, a Protestant. So goes through a formal sort of open conversion process, leaves his Greek Catholic community, and he then engages in a very bitter polemic with the head of that community that he's just leaving, the patriarch Maximus Mausoleum. But he has adopted this new Protestant position in a sense because he sees it as a rational religion. He sees it as a form of religion that can be rationally justified. And he retains that position for the rest of his life. He lives through and survives the massacres of 1860 and provides one of the most vivid, probably the most vivid testimony to that set of events. He writes his memoirs in 1873. He dies in 1888, you know, as a respected member of the Damascene community under the new style Tanzimat Ottoman Empire, but in many ways looking back still to the Shehebi Emirate of his youth. So through all of this, this theme of reason, al-aql, is very central to Michal Mashoka. And I think that, in a sense, to conclude, can provide us with one of these clues to what's going on between these two tendencies, if you like, to secularity on the one hand and religious identitarianism on the other in the 19th century. Because, you know, he belongs to both of these. He's massively interested in science and reason and thinking his way to the end of a problem. He's adopted as a figure of the Nahda by later sort of publicizers of that, like Georges Dedan. On the other hand, he's very much a religious activist. He's also central to shaping a Protestant community in Syria and takes attacking Catholicism in particular very seriously. So, you know, but to both of these projects, reason is central for him. And I think one can see him as part of a shift towards a new style of religious debate that emerges by the late 19th century in Arabic, in which it becomes very important to justify whatever it is one believes in terms of reason. And that can lead in rather different directions. One can say, okay, I'm going to judge all of these different religious faiths according to the light of reason and stand outside of them all, and this can lead to a secular position. On the other hand, if you place yourself within one of these faiths, one has to then rationally justify that as against other positions. And this means getting rid of all of the things which can be seen as superstitious, inconsistent, ambiguous, and coming up with a more sharply bounded sense of what one's religion is. And so that, in a sense, is how I would relate Michal Mashoka to the general problem that I began with. But there's very many other aspects of his life and, you know, weird and wonderful details that we can also discuss. Great.
And they're all documented for you here in Prophet of Reason, because you really have only just scratched the surface. But that was the point. a taster. Come back in questions for more detail. Could we beg you, Marilyn, to describe a little more about what you got up to with Zeynep for us?
Well, you don't have to beg me, except I do have to apologize for my voice, and I hope I can. I hope you can hear me at the back, and if it gives out, that will just give more time to my colleagues. It's always a pleasure to speak here in my alma mater, and I want to start by saying that literally my entire career I've been thinking about the study of biography, although for most of that, it's been the study of biography as a genre. And when I say literally, I mean going back to my undergraduate honors thesis on Mai Ziede and her biographies of other women's lives, which Albert Hourani read, and that's what led him to urge me to come to St. Anthony's. So I've really been interested in that, and particularly the question of how feminists use biography. And this is something not, of course, specific to the Arab world. I mean, women in many societies have used biographies of earlier women to try to counter the way in which women's lives and life stories and accomplishments have been suppressed. So I've been very interested in that, and I've written a lot about it. And that led me to Zeynep Fawaz, because she was very important in this. Her best-known work is a monumental biographical dictionary of world women in Arabic, published in 1895 in Cairo. My previous book was a book history of that book. So as you can tell, I'm rather obsessed with this woman, having now written two monographs on her. So I then went on and I wanted to work more on her because she is such a fascinating figure. I see her as very unusual among feminists and gender activists in the late 19th century. Her work came from a very deep, very explicit Muslim believer perspective. And within that, she uses that perspective to really mount a thoroughgoing critique of patriarchy and to have a much more anti-essentialist view of gender, much less focused on sort of natural gender roles than was true of most people writing on gender in the late 19th century. And so what I do in the book, it's an intellectual biography. I spend a lot of it really looking closely at her works. So her essays in the press in the 1890s, which covered everything from social justice to marriage, to the question of natural gender and other topics, girls' education. And I do that by really trying to place her in a community of writers, not all of whom, when I say community, a community can be antagonistic as well as friendly. So I look closely at the way that she was engaged in various public debates. And within that, I also try to look at some other writers who were actually not very, who were somewhat well known at the time, but are not the writers that we remember now. I also have chapters on her two novels, which are both historical novels, and her play. She was the first woman, as far as I know anyway, to have written, to have her name on a play that was published. There may have been others that women published anonymously. And in that chapter, I try to imagine the relationship between women and theater in the 1890s, because women didn't necessarily have access to the theater. So I try to look at all these different kinds of her writing. Now, as a person, who was she? Fascinating. And when I read Peter's book, I was so envious because you have so much information on Meshacha. And I have a very different situation with Zeynep Fawaz. So she was born, and here the problems start. She was born sometime between 1846 and 1860 in the town of Tibnin in Jebel Amel in the south of Lebanon. And different sources, support these different dates. I tend to think she was probably born in the either late 1840s, early 1850s. But, you know, I'm not sure because I have no real evidence. And that's a generation, 1846 to 1860, and it makes a huge difference in terms of her relationships with people whose dates we do know and with whom she was closely engaged. So she was born there. She spent her childhood in the castle, Jabal Qalat in Tibnin, the seat of the local feudal ruler. And this is also fascinating. And her first novel, which came out in 1899, is actually based on the story of that family, but she changes it for her own, I think, political purposes. So I look very closely at the history and then what she does to it in her novel. At some point, she emigrated to Egypt. Again, there are many stories about that, including one that she married an Egyptian army man and immigrated from Lebanon to Egypt. The problem with that is that there is no Egyptian husband in evidence once she gets to Egypt. So I actually don't believe that story, and I think probably it's an indication of the fact that people just could not believe that a woman would immigrate unless she was following a husband. You know, so I think some of the stories about her life have to do with people's attempts to explain things that don't seem very explicable. So she's in Egypt, she wrote. I won't go into all the details. I can certainly go into them more if you wish. At one point, she went to Damascus to marry a man. They'd had a correspondence. They'd never seen each other. And one of the possibly apocryphal stories is that she gets to Damascus, and they both discover that the photographs they sent each other were from a much younger age. She also discovered that he had either two or three other wives, which he had sort of forgotten to tell her about. And the marriage did not last a very long time, although apparently one of the reasons for that is that she missed the intellectual life of Cairo, and she missed the Cairo newspapers. So she came back to Egypt and did some writing, but then she died in 1914. For the last several years, she suffered from eye disease and was not very active, although there are certain spottings. But, and I will probably end with this, there is one source. My only real archival source on Zeynep Fawaz are the informant reports that she did for Abbas Helmi in the period sort of 1905 to 1907. These are absolutely fascinating. They are in the archives in Durham, the Abbas Helmi archives. I want to do more writing on those. What's fascinating is that here she is, a woman. She was hired to basically to go and hang out with her friends in elite homes, the other women, and she transcribes their conversations, or at least the version she wants the regime to have. And it's completely fascinating. I mean, for one thing, it shows that women were not at all isolated from politics. They knew exactly what was going on. Zeynep's handler, in writing to Abbas Helmi or someone close to him, wanting to justify hiring Zeynep Fawaz, said, listen, I think she can be of use to us. She can go into these homes. After all, husbands tell their wives everything. And she really pulls out this information. Now, for a feminist biographer of a feminist, this is quite difficult material. She's nasty. She lies to people. She uses the concept of girls' education cynically. That's what hurt me the most. She participates in basically getting a journalist thrown into jail. You know, this is not nice. And I was like, Zeynep, how can you do this to me? But it does humanize her. It really, again, shows us the complications of a life, the messiness of a life. And also, I think sometimes maybe forget is the way that people change as they get older. And maybe they have new needs, new agendas, new loyalties. We do know that she was quite poor after her brother died. Her brother was a lawyer in Cairo. He died in 1894. She was single. And I think partly she did this probably because she needed money. I think also that she wanted to be involved, and somehow this was something. And I also trace that, into sort of 1900, As things are becoming harder and harder in terms, as Egyptians are losing even more and more hope about the Egyptians, about the English leaving, about the end of the British occupation, she becomes a more hardline nationalist, and the nationalism tends to subsume her feminism a bit. So I try to trace that as well. So, you know, it's just fascinating dealing with the complexity of the human being and trying to think about her role in history, but of course also how her history shaped her and how it shapes our thinking now. So thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn. And again, Career and Communities of Zeynep Fawaz. Another community of impossible friends.
Yes, all right. Sonia. Thank you very much. So first of all, it's wonderful being back at Oxford. So thank you, Eugene, and everyone who organized this. It's wonderful also to see my former professors, but also to see my former students from AUB who are now doing their PhDs here at Oxford and at Cambridge. All right, so my book tells the story of this really extraordinary circle of friends in Jerusalem who came together across religious lines, so across Christianity, Islam, and Judaism before 1948. And my book consists of two parts. So the first part, I try to reconstruct in fragments what brought them together, what made their friendship possible. And then the second part, I look at the afterlives of that friendship. So what happened to them and what happened to their friendship after 1948. And I like to think that my book is as much about the present as it is about the past, because as we all know very well, this past, 1948, the Nakba is not past, it's ongoing. A Nakba al-Mustamirra, it's an ongoing Nakba. And I felt when I was writing this book, so it took me quite a while, I felt there was an urgency really to telling their story, because the individual lives are being lost, not only because they are all, Walid Khalid is the only one who's still alive, who turned 99 this summer, he's a gentleman on the left, not only because of that, but also because their lives are really being erased against the background of current ideologies in the Middle East and elsewhere, also in Europe, maybe in the UK it's not as bad as in Germany, but I believe also here it is a problem that we have these ideologies of one people, one religion, and one language. So I felt there was an urgency to telling their story, but certainly this urgency has increased since October 7. And the horrors we are witnessing in Gaza, in Lebanon, and elsewhere since. Now, I use the word story because for me it was very important to tell a story. So I try to liberate myself and also to encourage my students to do that from this academic straitjacket. My book still has way too many footnotes because at the same time I felt it was important to document everything carefully because there is such a battle over narratives when it comes to Israel-Palestine. But for me it was very important to tell a story, and I drew a lot of inspiration also from colleagues in creative writing, because I think we do need more storytelling, because stories connect us across time and space as human beings, and because stories give names and faces to a history that all too often has been reduced to numbers. And I tried to, so I'm also very fascinated, obsessed a bit with life writing, with biography. But I really try to bridge biography, which is more closely linked to literary studies, with microhistory. So to link literature and the social sciences. So to use this group portrait, if you want, as a lens to try to teach myself to understand better, but also to shed light on a larger context, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. All right, maybe I'll just say a few words about my protagonist. So many of you in this room, I assume, are familiar with some of them. Mm-hmm. Let me start with the one person that maybe here in the UK people are not so familiar with, which is Wolfgang Hildesheimer. He's seated in the middle of this portrait. He was born in 1916 in Hamburg, in the city that I grew up in. And he left, he was born into a German Jewish family, and he left Germany as a teenager with his parents and his sister in 1933 when the Nazis came to power. First to London, his father negotiated with Unilever to open a factory in Haifa, and then from London they went to Palestine. And when he first arrived in 33 in Palestine, he was really very much moving in the German Zionist circles of his parents. His parents were really convinced Zionists. But then when he obtained a passport, so the whole issue of passport, maybe we can come back to that later, is very intriguing also. So in 37, he obtained a Palestinian passport, which was issued by the British Mandate. He immediately left, went back to London to study graphic design. But then with the outbreak of World War II, he returned to Jerusalem. And having lived in London in the golden 30s, maybe we can say, I don't know, before World War II, it was very cosmopolitan. Coming back then to Jerusalem, he took a distance from the German Zionist circles of his parents and moved in British and Palestinian Arab circles. And this is when he met Walid Khalidi and Jabra Ibrahim Jabra, who are seated at the far ends of this portrait. Walid with a pipe in his mouth and Jabra a pipe in his hand. I'm sure some of you are familiar with Jabra Ibrahim Jabra. He later became a really well-known figure in modern Arabic literature, translated Shakespeare, also painted, was an art critic, literature critic, and so on. Walid Khalidi, the great Palestinian historian and public intellectual who co-founded the Institute for Palestine Studies, which has branches today in Beirut and Washington, D.C. So these people are, these three men are pretty well known. Wolfgang Hildesheimer became very well known in post-war German literature. He returned actually to Europe, first to London and then to Germany in 1946, convinced that his place is in Europe and not in Palestine. Maybe I'll say more about that later. So just very briefly. So he returned to London, tried to establish himself as a graphic artist in London, but that was difficult, so he had to earn some money. He heard that the US embassy was looking for translators, interpreters. So he applied for the job, he got it, and this is how he returned to Germany with the Allies, and then he worked as an interpreter in the Nuremberg trials and decided to stay in Germany, and then he got involved with the so-called Gruppe 47, which is a very important literary group, Günter Grass, Ingeborg Bachmann, Paul Celan, and so on, and started to write in German. Late 50s, he was very fed up with Germany, thinking that Germany is going fascist again, and left for Switzerland, and this is where he remained until he passed away in the 90s. Now, I'm not going to say more about Jabra and Walid, but let me very briefly say something about the two women. So, like many other women the world over, they did not leave any publications behind, and thus also it was very difficult to find out more about their lives. I was very lucky that Waleed Khalidi trusted me and gave me access to his personal archive and also to the unpublished memoirs of his wife, Rasha. So Rasha Salam is from a big Lebanese family which championed women's emancipation and Arab nationalism. And she later married Waleed, and much later in the 80s, she wrote her memoirs. So that helped me to really find out more about her life. Sally Kassab, unfortunately, I wasn't that lucky, and this is why also I do not devote a chapter to Sally in my book. And we can talk more about this also maybe later. What do we do when we are confronted with gaps and silences in the archive? Do we try to use our imagination to fill these gaps, or do we mark them as gaps? How do we deal with that? All right. A few words about the archives. So I'm telling their story. If you want, I try to let the archive guide me, right? So I draw on a lot of unpublished material, as I mentioned, memoirs, photographs, letters. But certainly this also means that sometimes it's a bit like a puzzle, right? Because you find bits and pieces and then you're putting that together. And also there are a lot of surprises. So here I was in Beirut working about this group of friends in Jerusalem, but then the archive sent me back to Germany, to the UK, to the US, because Palestinian archives are as dispersed as Palestinians themselves. All right, maybe let me fast forward a little bit and say, go back and fast forward. So in addition to these two parts, my book has a prologue and an epilogue. And the prologue, I open my book with the King David Hotel bombing in 1946 for two reasons. First, because this group of friends used to come together at the bar of the King David Hotel for drinks, so this is where they used to meet regularly. This is one of the reasons. And the last time they came together was actually the day before that bombing, which was a terrorist attack carried out by the Irgun. And symbolically speaking, we can say that it was that bombing that made their friendship impossible. Now let me fast forward to my epilogue. So in my epilogue, I look at a belated correspondence between Rasha and Wolfgang. So in Jerusalem, it was actually Wolfgang and Sally who were known as a couple, but Rasha seems to also have had a crush on Wolfgang. They all had a crush on each other. It was fairly, there are some juicy stories in my book as well. The 40s, early 40s in Jerusalem, a lot was possible, not only friendship. So apparently she had a crush on Wolfgang back then. And in the 80s, so 40 years later, after she and her husband, Waleed, had left Beirut after 82, after the Israeli invasion and the Sabra and Shatila massacres and so on, she finds herself in the US and she starts writing her memoirs, so those memoirs which remain unpublished. And while she was writing her memoirs, she reached out to Wolfgang and started this really amazing correspondence, which I found more or less by accident in the archives, Wolfgang's archives, which are at the Academy of Arts in Berlin. So in this belated correspondence, it's really moving, touching to see how they reconnect, right? And I'll just leave you now with the last letter. In the last letter that is preserved in the archives, Wolfgang writes to Russia that he and his wife, Sylvia, that they would like to become Arabs. But he doesn't know, he's saying, but how does one go about that? And it took me a while, so this is in the 80s, right? People change, there are messy contradictions. Wolfgang also didn't remain anti-Zionist all his life. In 1967, unfortunately, he defended very much Israel and this idea that it was fighting for its very existence and blah, 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 which we know the new historians, Avi Schleim is here, that this is right, that this is not true. So, but in the 80s, he became again critical of Israeli politics, critical of Israel. And so when he writes that he and his wife would like to become Arabs, I had some problems really understanding first what he meant by that. But then I read it in constellation with something else, which he wrote about his boss in Jerusalem. He was working for the Palestine Information Office, which was kind of a British Ministry of Information at the time, putting up exhibitions and so on across Palestine. And his boss, Christopher Holm, who later worked for the BBC, they became very close friends later. And at one point, Wolfgang said, yes, one could be friends, or one could become friends when the colonial constellation was over. So why, what does he mean with we would like to become Arabs? I think what he is saying that would like to become local, integrated into the Arab world. But we see that this is impossible as long as this colonial constellation remains intact. And let me just end with a few words on my book title. So the title is borrowed from Mahmoud Darwish and his Rita poems. And I like this idea of an impossible love or an impossible friendship, because certainly, at least in English, in Arabic, doesn't really make sense like that. But in English, the possibility of that impossible friendship is inscribed in the very word impossible. So yeah, let me end with that. And then maybe we can go back to also some of the characters. I like to call them my famous five. So maybe we can go back to them in the discussion.
Thank you, Sonia. And thank you all for giving us such an enticing taste of your books. And there's so much to pick out of even the small sampling you've given us. But I'm going to pick up on something you've said, Sonia, about what one does with the gaps in your documentation. And I'm going to jump right over you, because I mean, one of the things that's fun about your books is that you're able to write men and women into history in a way which is all too often not done. And so much of the history has been a history of men. Now, Peter, you're probably guiltier of that in the three books we have before us. And I wonder what that says about the place of women in the Damascus or the Syria of Mishaka's time and of his life. So if you could, where are the women in the Mishaka book?
Where are the women? I mean, they're not very present. I mean, I admit it. And certainly this is, you know, Michal Mishaka is quite unique, as we've said, for, you know, the amount of documentation that one can find about him for somebody in Syria of the 19th century. But he's a man, and, you know, one can't find for a woman, even a prominent woman like Zeynep Fawaz, one has, you know, a story with many, many more holes in it. And the women in Michal Mishaka's life, I mean, in a lot of the records that one has, the more public records, they're even more absent than they are in my book. So again, you know, to go back to this question of sources, one has Michal Mishaka writing his own autobiography, one has his religious polemics, one has his correspondence with Eli Smith, his great friend, the American missionary, one has, you know, traces of him in all sorts of other archives and descriptions of him and, you know, bits and pieces of annotations of manuscripts and so on. It was only towards the very end of the project that I managed to get in touch with the descendants of the Mashapa family, who had preserved a family archive in Damascus, which they then took abroad out of Damascus a few years ago. Three suitcases, no. And among this, one has Michal Mashapa's private notes on family affairs, where he has written in the fly leaves of a book accounts of important lives, important moments in the lives of himself and members of the family. And it was only when I found these that I could get, for instance, the original baptismal name of his wife, who is referred to as Khanum Mashapa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, lady or, you know, sort of honorific title in all of these public-facing accounts. And in his record of his marriage, he has her as Elizabeth Elidabat. And that's the first time I'd found that, you know. And so it's even that level of information to find, you know, is difficult.
And who was Khanum? Who was Elisabetta?
She was the daughter of another, you know, Greek Catholic family in Damascus. And she married Michal Mashapa when she was at a very young age.
How young?
11, I think. Yeah. And he was in his 30s, mid-30s. This was not uncommon. His son, in the next generation, had a similar, you know, age gap at the time of marriage. And again, you know, what does one do with the bits of information that one finds about this? There's a comment in a book by another missionary later on, Women of the Arabs by Henry Harris Jessop, saying, talking to Michal Mashapa and him commenting on the fact that they used to marry at such a young age with these age gaps. And he said, well, you know, we have to train our wives to look after us. You know, they don't know how to look after us properly unless we have, you know, raised them up in the tradition of doing this from being very young girls, this kind of thing. And again, there are these not only gaps, but rather alienating things about the characters that the one encounters. There's rather little about, you know, other female characters in his story as well, unfortunately.
No, but I wanted you to go to the background of his marriage, because it really was something that came out of your book. I certainly never saw references in his personal writings that I had access to. And, you know, it's quite extraordinary to see him marrying someone so young. He sounds practically like a Trump cabinet nominee. Thank you, audience.
Thank you. But she doesn't. It's not that she doesn't play a role, you know, or have independent views of her own, because she never becomes a Protestant. She's strongly opposed to the idea of him becoming a Protestant, I think. She remains a Catholic. And there's a later letter, one of the few places she does turn up in his correspondence with Eli Smith, is when he's saying, well, she's trying to turn our son against me by, you know, convincing him not to be so favourable to Protestantism. So I need to send him away to your mission school to get him out of his mother's influence. So what that household was like, I don't know. But that's the thing. One doesn't know behind the doors of the household.
But I'm going to say one thing you said, glimpses. Peter, which is that, you know, this complicates the life. You find out these details and you realise that there are some things about people that maybe you don't like. And that comes right back to your exploration of Fawaz. Mm. And I want to come back to the question about her opposition to girls' education. And I'm wondering whether that was in any way linked to Qasim Amin and the debates going on at the end of the 19th century. Yeah. Did I misunderstand?
So, no, that's fine. It's a good question. She was not opposed to girls' education. She uses this at a moment in 1906, I think it is, in order to try to... She uses it cynically. It's not necessarily opposed to it. She uses it in order to try to get another woman involved in the spy network.
The spy networks?
Well, informant network, I should say. Yeah, more informant
of the Khedives.
So she's trying to get other women involved, and she entices this woman by sort of saying, oh, we're thinking of setting up a school. Can you come to a meeting? So it's not... I don't want to say it's an opposition. I may have put it badly.
No, but you did say cynical, misunderstanding.
But it's you know. But she's using a concept. But she's really interesting on education. She's definitely not against it, but she does not, at least not very often and not very loudly, go into the maternalist discourse that was so important and so grounding for arguments about girls' education at the time. That is, you know, the standard argument was, we've got to have girls' schools because we have to teach girls how to become good wives and mothers, right. Which kind of links into what you were just saying about Elisabetta. And, you know, there was a strong focus on domestic arts. And also, you know, okay, yes, you need to teach girls to read because they're going to need to do, you know, they're going to need to do some reading. You need to teach them elementary math so that they can do the household budget. But it was very instrumentalist. Now, of course, girls could use that for other purposes. So, you know, it's one of these things. But she did not, Fawez did not emphasize the maternalist. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that one has to do when writing a biography or any history really is also listen to the silences. You know, what did she not say? And so in terms of education, I think she was quite canny about what she said, but she wasn't at all against it.
Well, keeping the focus on women in our histories, you know, I wonder, Sonia, whether you would have chosen the five people who were the focus of your group biography were it not for this photograph. And specifically, you were saying that for one of the two women in the photograph, you have such a gap in the documentation. Rasha, you've got so much material, you've got her diaries. And so, you know, it's quite an interesting lens to bring as you want to frame a study. But maybe it's just unfortunate that the wrong woman's in the picture and that there would have been another friend for whom you would have had better documentation.
Possibly. This said, I think it is actually important also to mark the gap. So, okay, to have a woman there and to have her picture, and everyone I interviewed quite a lot of old men, I have to say. They always pointed out that, you know, she's so good looking and I don't know what. So, but it was really difficult to find out more about her. But I eventually did. And sometimes I think maybe I should have written a very short chapter, but she does pop up in the other chapters, definitely. So I feel it's a bit like, you know, you have a spotlight mm-hmm. on certain characters, mm-hmm. and then when it comes to her, she's a bit more in the dark, mm-hmm. But she's still there. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important, I agree with what Marilyn said, to give a place also to those silences.
Definitely. I actually think it adds something quite ambiguous and enticing to the group biography to have one who is a bit mysterious in that way, mm-hmm. for whom you don't have complete information. Mm-hmm. And of the three of our panelists, of course, you're the only one who's had the privilege to talk with one of your subjects. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your engagement with Walid al-Khairidi, mm-hmm. his role in opening up Rasha's writings and mm-hmm. world to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, he really helped you make this project, mm-hmm. realize this project.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, I should say that I started working on Jabra because I worked on him for my PhD, and I always felt that that was the weakest chapter. My supervisor seems to agree. So I wanted to go back to him and started working on him, and then how, you know, sometimes things happen by accident. So I ran into my colleague, Tarif Khalidi, on campus. He asked me, what are you working on? I told him Jabra. He was excited, told me, you should meet my half-brother, Walid. He was friends with him in Jerusalem. So next time Walid comes to Beirut, I meet Walid, and Walid tells me, yes, we were this very close group of friends, and he tells me about Wolfgang and so on. I honestly wasn't really familiar with Wolfgang Hildesheimer, even though he's quite well known, as I said earlier, in post-war German language literature. So then when I was on sabbatical later in Berlin for a year, I went to check out those archives of Wolfgang Hildesheimer in Berlin, and this is where I found really amazing material, a beautiful letter that Jabra sent to Wolfgang in the early 50s when he was on a scholarship in Harvard, trying to reach out after 48 to his friend, also telling him what happened to him in 48. And I found those letters between Rasha and Wolfgang. And then I got in touch again with Walid, and I think so I went to see him a number of times afterwards in the US, and with the idea to interview him. But then, I mean, you know, Walid Khalidi, he's not like the kind of person you can go and interview, right? So those interviews, and I describe that a bit in my book, kind of turned into private tutorials, right? That's a format he was familiar with since he was an Oxford don. So, and I was very grateful. So I had these private tutorials. He was teaching me about the history of Palestine. So I think, through Walid also, I became friends with this group of friends, right? And he, I would say, became not only my tutor, my professor, but also a friend. And he trusted me, I think, because he saw also that I had already done some archival research before coming to him. And he was actually also very happy and grateful because he's also writing, I mean, I think he finished now his own memoirs. And I was able to help him quite a bit with information about his friends, right? So things he didn't know about Wolfgang, but also in the archives at AUB, for example, I found a lot of material. So Tamam Salam, the son of Sa'ab Salam, who is Rasha's brother, gave the archives of his father and grandfather to AUB. So there are lots of family photographs. And among those photographs, I also found a number of pictures also of Walid as a young boy and so on. Yes, archival research really, I got a bit obsessed also with that and with my friends. I was really living day and night with them, especially during COVID when I finished writing my book. Yes, archival research takes you places, like you travel, it's a journey and, yeah, you make a lot of friends also with archivists, but sometimes also with people you interview.
Well, you're lucky having that opportunity to actually meet and talk with one of the subjects of your, I mean, basically historic research. Mm-hmm. You talk about Walid al-Khalidi's Oxford experiences. They ended, what, 68 years ago with the Suez Crisis, and he resigned his post in protest here at the Faculty of Oriental Studies, as it was then. Maybe. I'm going to end with one that I'd like the three of you to talk about, and then I promise, audience, I am going to open up to you. Because at the heart of your books are community and rupture. Mm-hmm. You talk about communities, Marilyn, you know. You talk about the break with the Greek Catholic community. And obviously, 1948, the Nakba scatters this community in ways that they could not have anticipated when they first forged their friendship. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about community and rupture in the histories that you've written. And let's start with you, Marilyn, and we'll come back this way.
Sure. You know, I think one thing that all of our books do, if I may presume, and you can, of course, disagree with me, is that we really break up the notion that that Sonia referred to of this sort of, you know, a community defined as X, a community defined as Y. It's often in the Middle East, you know, these assumptions about communities that are defined according to religious origin. And one of the things that's really interesting to me about Zeynep Fawaz is that, now, as I said, she is very much speaking from within a perspective as a believer and drawing on Islamic sources in her work. However, she also worked with women of other backgrounds, and I have a chapter on El Fetet, the first women's magazine, the first magazine in Arabic, 1892, Alexandria, that was edited by women, and it was specifically for a female audience. And I see that journal, it's usually been ascribed to sort of one woman's initiative. I see it as a collective project. And the reason I'm mentioning it is that it was, you know, it was Muslim, Christian, Jewish women. women from Ottoman Syria and from Egypt. It was a community of a different sort and a kind of associational attempt, an associational project across kind of boundaries. And so I think that all of our work shows these kind of communities that might not be expected or that one might not necessarily know about until looking closely at the lives of some of these people who were involved. But then rupture comes in, not necessarily with this particular group, but, you know, as I said, I mean, Fawez, as time went on, she got angrier about, as did many others, about what was going on with the British occupation. She was also very angry. She has a couple of articles where she very sharply rebukes the elite men of Egypt for, you know, laziness and hypocrisy, basically. She says, you know, you're not doing enough. You're not doing what you should be doing for this nation. And I suspect that, you know, that caused some splits. But then other kinds of community, one thing that I've learned more about due to another archive, another press archive since publishing the book, you know, this is always your nightmare, right? You know, you publish the book, it's done, and then you find this great source, and you're like, oh my God. I found out that her brother was actually quite important in Masonic circles in Cairo, which is fascinating because Fawez, her family, you know, they were really identified with the nationalists, and with she published articles in El-Luet, and here her brother Mohammed is like Shaheen Makarios's right-hand man, and he was a major supporter of the British. So, you know, then you start having to really think about what does community mean. And of course, there's just so much we don't know because we only have the writings. We can't listen to the conversations. So I don't know if that answers
it does.
Your question.
Bridge building, bridge burning. Yeah, these are fascinating elements of our complex individuals and the communities in which they lived. Peter?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a theme. I mean, there is, I suppose, early on in Michel Meshokwa's story, there is one of these rather sort of lost communities, which is the young men, mainly Greek Catholic men in terms of their sort of formal religious affiliation, but who are, like him, attracted to deist ideas and are there discussing Voltaire and Volney, you know, in Damietta, probably in one of these kind of, you know, Khan Wakerlas overlooking the Nile. And these are young men in their teens and 20s, you know, trying out these new ideas and pushing at the boundaries of what you can believe and think. And again, you know, it's perhaps a sort of counter community like that that makes you think, well, you know, what are these boxes into which we put people? In this case, religious boxes. Christians, Muslims, Jews, Catholic, Orthodox, Sunni, Shia. What happens if you open the box and you see that there's a rather messier reality inside? And that manifests itself in an individual like Michel Meshokwa, but also in communities of discussion like that. But of course, later in his life, he very much is you know, part of a community in a more formal religious sense, which is the Protestant one. And so he has to go through an experience of rupture to get there. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think of him again in Damascus, you know, a sort of prosperous Ottoman subject with very good connections among people of many different religious communities. But even before he becomes a Protestant, having problems with the Greek Catholic community under Maximus Mazlum, the reforming patriarch, defining itself in a rather more rigid way, in a way that tends to, you know, sap the authority of the kind of wealthy lay elite families such as his own, and put them more under clerical authority and you know, tell them what to do. And he doesn't like being told what to do, and particularly he doesn't like being told what to believe. And so there is a kind of individualism of rupture with a new style communal project that nonetheless, this is a thing, has to lead him in that moment into a new community, into the Protestant community that he is then very central to actually, you know, forming as something distinct in Damascus. So there is something of a tension, I think, between him trying to forge an individual intellectual pathway and finding a way of doing this in moving between these religious communities, which are themselves becoming more sharply defined. And we can find other examples of that at that moment of the sort of mid-19th century of intellectuals. I think thinks of Ahmed Ferdinand Shijjar, for instance, you know, but there are many others one could point to, who go through different transitions from one religious community to another. And in a society that is coming to define itself even more sharply than before, I think, in terms of religious affiliation in one sense, this is then possible to, you know, as a form of individuality, to find some, you know, through moments of rupture, if you like. And this is also prior to another moment when it is actually possible to think of a secular project and a secular public sphere and, you know, defining oneself in that way and not having to worry so much about religious affiliation. So it's this rather kind of awkward transitional moment that is difficult to define in terms of our later understandings.
So I guess in my book I look at two different kinds of communities. First, maybe communities, the social religious communities that my protagonists were born into. And in each chapter, I try to really also shed light on that context. And it's quite astonishing that they actually came together, not only in terms of religious diversity, but also really social background and class, because there you have Walid Khalidi, who's kind of, you know, old Jerusalemite family, Muslim family, sort of aristocracy, if you want, and Jabra, who's really, who's Syria Christian, was born in the region of Adana and came as a young boy, 2-3 years old, to Bethlehem, really as a refugee, and was barefooted throughout his childhood, and then really through education, scholarships, had this social mobility. He was admitted to the Arab College, which was the highest educational institution, Arab educational institution in Palestine, and then later obtained scholarships to go to Exeter and Cambridge before he returned then to teach at his former school in Jerusalem. So there's this social and religious communities background, but then, you know, there's friendship, which is the kind of community or the communities we build, right? Which depends maybe more on our choices, the choices we make, on our preferences and so on. But then this friendship really, became impossible, or then the rupture really caused certainly by the Nakba, but by political violence, we can say, or by, with every bombing, right, there is also the possibility of friendship that is being destroyed. I talked earlier about the interviews I did with Walid Khalidi. It was very interesting because he distinguished between the friendship that was possible between Arabs and Jews. And we know these are categories that are not carved in stone, but were very much invented by European and in particular British colonialism, just like the Middle East, right? So he told me he drew a difference between his generation, where such friendship was already really rare. I mean, he remembers a few Jewish boys in his schools who were Arab Jews, but they didn't have much contact. But he said the generation of his father, there was much more friendship, right? And he really draws a line with 1917, the Balfour Declaration. And one such friendship that I look at, but it's really on the fringes of all this, but that I hope now to write an essay about, is the friendship between his father, Ahmad Sameh Al-Khalidi, who was the head of the Arab College, and Yuda Magnus, who was the rector, the first president of the Hebrew University. they were friends, and it makes a lot of sense that they were friends because they were also colleagues. Sure. They worked together. They were both the heads of the highest Jewish and Arab educational institutions, and there were also plans of turning the Arab College into a university. But their friendship is nowhere mentioned, right? I mention it briefly, and now I'm writing about it. But if you read, there are, I think there's one or two biographies on Magnus, no mention of Ahmad Sameh al-Khalidi. And there's a reason for this, because we always read these histories as separate histories, right? Magnus we read in terms of Israeli history, right? Yes. And Khalidi in terms of Palestinian history, but we don't read them together. So one of the aims, what I found very intriguing, I didn't plan it like this, but just following my characters, if you want, life trajectories, made it possible for me to read these histories together. And also because of Wolfgang Hildesheimer and also his experience later on as an interpreter at Nuremberg, which really traumatized him, to read together the Holocaust and the Nakba, not in comparison, but as linked and tangled histories. Mm. So I was able to, it wasn't planned like this, but just like following these life trajectories, yes, you have to read these histories together. So for me, that was also really eye-opening.
Well, these are rich and fascinating books about rich and fascinating lives, and I can't recommend them to you strongly enough, just for your own reading pleasure, or who knows, for a little bit of inspiration of where you might want to go next to fill the gaps in the lack of biography in this field. But if you want to know, where are the people in the history of the Middle East? Where are the people? These books will give you a good answer. Will you please join me in giving the very warmest of thanks to our two speakers? Thank you.
Amazing. You want to mention that they're on sale upstairs.